Good morning, everyone. The court's ready to hear argument in Lewis versus Ward. Are you ready to proceed? Good morning, Mr. Rosenthal.
Good morning, Your Honor. I rise simply to introduce my colleague in this litigation, Irving Bazar, a member of the New York Bar. He has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with Your Honor's permission, he will argue on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
May it please the court. In the context of a merger of two corporations in a stock-for-stock exchange, we ask that this court review, reconsider, and reverse the application of Lewis against Anderson in that situation. In the words of Chancellor Chandler, there is no principled economic reason for a bar to continue and prevent the continuation of this kind of litigation. The commentators have criticized Lewis against Anderson. For example, Wolf and Pittenger, cited in our brief, is one of the commentators who have criticized the application of Lewis against Anderson. In addition, the American Law Institute, in the Principles of Corporate Governance, Section 7.02A2, equally has criticized the application of Lewis against Anderson. Chancellor Chandler, as I said, in the case of Ashe against McCall in footnote 47, indicated there was no principled economic reason to justify a bar of the continuation of such a suit. Chancellor Allen, earlier in the Caremark litigation, permitted the case to go forward notwithstanding the merger so that a settlement could take place. A number of states have looked at the Lewis-Anderson rule, and they have also similarly refused to continue or apply Lewis against Anderson. These cases are cited at page 2 of our brief. That's Indiana, California, North Carolina, Minnesota, and indeed the Third Circuit in the Rails case. I may also ask the court to consider the United States Supreme Court case, which we didn't cite, should have cited. The case is Goulust, G-O-L-L-U-S-T, against Mendel. In 501 U.S. 115, held that in a 16B case, notwithstanding the fact that the nominal defendant on whose behalf the suit had been brought was merged out of existence, nevertheless, the plaintiff had the economic interest to continue the litigation. Permitting this litigation to continue, we submit, is consistent with Section 327 and its progeny. 327 is supposed to prevent someone purchasing a claim. It's equally supposed to prevent defendants from using 327 to insulate themselves from liability. To that end, the Chancery Court has, and this court has permitted in Schaff against Wiley, to permit a suit to commence after a spinoff because the plaintiff had the economic interest and was claiming wrongs that arose prior to the spinoff, although the plaintiff himself did not own shares at the time of the wrong in the company that eventually spun off. He owned the shares in the parent. Equally in Schreiber against Carney, the Chancery Court permitted the continuation when a company was reorganized and divided into halves and permitted the case to continue. The rationale for these cases is that the plaintiff hasn't purchased the claim but has the economic interest to continue the case. At bar, the same principles apply, we submit. Amex Gold was merged into Kinross. If Amex Gold was the survivor, no one would question Lewis's right to continue this litigation. It was not the survivor, simply because of a lawyer's technique of restructuring. Nevertheless, Lewis still has the economic interest because she owns the shares in the parent. She didn't voluntarily buy this claim. Indeed, she was merged into without even her vote. The shareholders of Amex Gold were not permitted to vote. They weren't given appraisal rights. And clearly, she has no evil motive in pursuing this case. The case was pending for 2 years before the merger. The parties had had some 10,000 pages of discovery. They had even discussed settlement before the merger took place. We submit, therefore, that Schaff against Wiley, Schreiber against Carney, and those lines of cases would permit this case to continue or a slight extension of those rules. Now, it has been argued by the defendants, and will be argued, I assume, here today, that plaintiff has a remedy, could bring a double derivative case. We would submit that's an illusory remedy. In the first place, there's a statute of limitations, major issue. In the second place, Kinross is not a Delaware entity, and there's no way the Delaware courts could obtain jurisdiction over Kinross. I come back to where I began, if it please your honors. I come back to the argument at the end, in the words of Chancellor Chandler, that there is no principled economic reason not to permit this case to continue. Alternatively,
may I interrupt
for
a moment? Did you make that argument to the trial court?
Yes, we did. Maybe not as articulately as we do here, but we did argue that.
Is there anything in the opinion to discuss that issue?
Not to my knowledge. The court felt that it was, and I'm summarizing it, I may not be accurate in my summary, the court felt that somehow it couldn't possibly have been a restructuring, as I was now going to argue, that we fall at least within footnote 10 of Lewis against Anderson, because it was structured in such a way as to prevent this case to continue, because Amex Gold gave more assets to the merger.
Now,
and so
I think
the court focused on the question of you didn't plead the fraud, you didn't, there was sort of business judgment kind of decision.
Okay, but that really wasn't the point of my question. Your argument that we should allow this type of derivative suit to continue because there's a real economic interest that survives and so on, was that argument presented to the trial court?
Well, I thought it was. I may not have been articulate enough to say it so clearly, but we did argue that.
Okay, and did I miss in the opinion, there was just
opinion
no discussion
didn't focus
about
on it. The opinion felt it was bound by Lewis against Anderson. So it had no room, as it were, to suggest that perhaps time had come not to apply it. I might also add that we also argued, at least in our briefs, although the law changed, that subsequently, while the case was pending and subsequent to our briefing on this issue, the company had merged into a Nevada entity, and we were going to argue that Nevada law applied. Unfortunately, by the time we got up to argue it, Nevada ruled that it was going to follow Delaware law. So we're back to Lewis against Anderson. So we now argue that it should not be applied to this case. The rest of the arguments we've set forth, and I'm done.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Lafferty.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, on August 28, 2000, then-Vice Chancellor Jacobs dismissed the original complaint in this action and gave the plaintiffs leave to amend. And then in a well-reasoned decision on October 29th, Vice Chancellor Strine dismissed the amended complaint with prejudice. This is the appeal from both of those opinions and orders. In this appeal, plaintiff comes right out and says it wants this court to overturn over 20 years of settled Delaware law on the issue of post-merger standing for a plaintiff in a derivative action. The Lewis versus Anderson case held that a plaintiff who ceases to be a shareholder, whether by reason of a merger or for any other reason, loses such standing to continue a derivative suit. The rule in Lewis has been a bedrock principle in Delaware corporate law for 20 plus years, frankly longer than that, because if your honors go back and read the Lewis case, it recounts 20 or 30 more years of history prior to that, construing the continuous ownership requirement under Delaware law. Here we submit there's nothing unique about the facts of this case or the application of Lewis to those facts to justify abandoning a well-settled precedent of this court. Despite being given the opportunity to re-examine, overrule, or modify Lewis v. Anderson in recent years, both in Parnes and at First Interstate, this court has declined to do so, and we submit for good reason. For the reasons that are set forth fully in our briefs, you know, in which I will touch on briefly in a moment, we respectfully submit that the court should reaffirm Lewis versus Anderson and thereby affirm the Court of Chancery's dismissal of this case with prejudice.
Excuse me, I've must confess that I've forgotten. In Lewis v. Anderson, was the former stockholder still a stockholder of the merged company or not?
Your Honor, in Lewis v. Anderson, it involved the acquisition of Conoco by DuPont, and DuPont did that in a two-step transaction. It did a tender offer, a cash tender offer, and acquired a majority of the Conoco, what was called old Conoco in the opinion. And then it did that through a wholly owned subsidiary, and then it merged old Conoco into a wholly owned subsidiary of DuPont. And in that back-end merger, the shareholders of old Conoco, who didn't tender for cash, got shares in DuPont, the parent holding company, and the plaintiff in that case was presumably a shareholder of DuPont at that point in time.
So in that respect, the facts are parallel.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank
absolutely
you.
Parallel. Your Honor, the first point that I want to make is the one that we set forth in our brief about stare decisis, and this is not to be taken lightly. In asking a court in Delaware or anywhere to overturn settled precedent, plaintiff makes no mention of the high standard that she must meet. The fundamental precepts in Lewis v. Anderson have been consistently reaffirmed by the courts, and they should be affirmed here today. The necessity for stability in our law and mandates that these settled points not be overruled lightly, and that the court will only do so in very rare circumstances where there is a clear manifestation of error and urgent reasons to modify an existing precedent. This court had recently recounted that standard in the Leonard Lubenthal versus Hilton Hotels case, and there's one point I think I would make from that, which is a quote at page 248 where the court said, once a point of law has been settled by a decision of this court, it forms a precedent which is not afterwards to be departed from or lightly overruled or set aside, and it should be followed except for urgent reasons and upon clear manifestation of error. Here, Your Honors, there has been no showing under that standard. Indeed, the plaintiff has offered no new argument that the court has not already considered and rejected and deemed unpersuasive in other cases. Indeed, as recently as March of 2000, this court had the first interstate appeal and had the opportunity to reconsider or overrule the Lewis versus Anderson case. But again, in the context of a stock-for-stock merger like we have here, but elected not to do so. Given that throughout the lengthy course of this litigation, which dates back, I think the original complaint was filed around 1997, or maybe it was even 1996, plaintiff had an alternative way to go about attempting to pursue this derivative claim, a course of action that the plaintiff has failed to pursue. That is a double derivative suit on behalf of the parent company that Ms. Lewis presumably still owns stock, Kinross Gold. Kinross was the company that merged with, through a wholly owned subsidiary, into AMAX Gold. Plaintiff has eschewed that potential avenue, and under these circumstances, we submit there's nothing unique or urgent or compelling about plaintiff's position in this appeal that would prompt the court to abandon its settled precedent. Now, the policies that underlie Lewis versus Anderson are much broader than just simply Section 327, which is all that the plaintiff wants to focus on here. There are other provisions of the Delaware corporate law and policies that are at stake. In the Lewis versus Anderson case, the court made clear that Rules 23.1, Section 259A, and Section 327 all have been construed together to require that in the context of a corporate merger, a derivative shareholder must not only be a stockholder at the time of the alleged wrong and at the time of the commencement of the suit, but also must maintain that status throughout the litigation. And Your Honors, recall 23.1 has to do with the demand requirement requiring a stockholder prior to bringing a claim to make a demand on the board of a company or to alleged demand futility. 259A is the provision of the corporate law that says that in a merger situation, the assets of the old company become assets of the new merged entity. In this case, the claim that the plaintiff had was an asset of AMAX Gold. That asset was transferred as part of the merger to the new company. That asset is one that the board of the new company ought to have the right to determine whether or not to pursue. That is the derivative litigation itself. And so we submit what plaintiff should have done here was to make a demand on the Kinross board to pursue a double derivative suit. Plaintiff has simply failed to do that for these many, many years. The policies, I think, again, underlying Lewis versus Anderson make clear that it goes beyond simply the 327 policy, which is to prevent the purchasing of claims and the like. And we don't dispute that that is the underlying policy of 327. But Lewis versus Anderson is broader than that. The policy also focuses on the fact that those derivative claims pass by operation of law to the surviving company. And that's frankly a policy that the plaintiffs have simply not addressed at all in their papers. We talked a little bit about the facts, I think, in Lewis versus Anderson. I think we've covered that pretty well. That there are other precedents of this court that are relevant to the decision that are addressed in our papers. Kramer versus Western Pacific, that was a cash out merger as opposed to a stock for stock, but the court there applied Lewis in very strong manner and reiterated that there are just two exceptions to that rule. One is where the merger itself is the subject of a claim of fraud being perpetrated merely to deprive stockholders of standing to bring a derivative case, or if the merger is merely a reorganization which does not affect the plaintiff's ownership in the business enterprise. And throughout the course of this litigation, I think until Mr. Bizarre argued this morning, the plaintiffs have always said that they were attempting to plead a claim for fraud in the merger. That's what their complaint says. They've never come right out and argued the second prong of Lewis versus Anderson, which is the mere, quote-unquote, mere reorganization exception. The bottom line is it doesn't matter. Your Honors can consider both of those. I think, frankly, neither one of them apply in this circumstance. The plaintiffs relied in this court on the Shea versus Wiley case. That case was one that, frankly, Your Honor, Justice Steele decided when he was on the Chancery Court. That case involved a spinoff transaction where parent company, where the plaintiff shareholder owned stock, spun off a subsidiary. The plaintiff had challenged actions that were taken at the subsidiary level, but when he brought his derivative case post spinoff, the defendant said, "Well, you don't have standing to pursue those claims." The court said, under these circumstances, these unique circumstances, because the plaintiff wound up owning stock in both the parent and the new spun off company that was formerly subsidiary, the court said there's no reason to apply the Lewis versus Anderson rule technically. And the reason it did it was because it essentially fell into the second category of the mere reorganization type transactions that are accepted from the Lewis rule. That's not the case here. I mean, this was an arm's-length merger between two separate companies. It wasn't a spin-off transaction. Each of those companies had separate assets, separate boards of directors, and frankly, in this case, unlike the Shave case where Your Honor was concerned about there being a potential wrong without a remedy, here the plaintiffs have a remedy. They had the option of going to the Kinross board and asking the Kinross board to pursue a double derivative claim. They simply have failed to do that, and the court should not step in to help them here. The other cases the plaintiffs cite, Shriver and Helfand, also are mere reorganization exceptions to the Lewis rule, and they're frankly not on point. Shriver or Helfand involved a situation where a company was required under antitrust laws to divest itself, and it was a mere reorganization where the plaintiff wound up owning stock in two companies rather than one. Helfand was a holding company merger that simply set up a shell holding company, and they merged up into the parent, and the plaintiff owned basically the same interest in the parent that it had in the merged company. So the court said that was, you know, without substance. Again, unlike the facts in this case, which this merger was a merger of real substance. The Blasband case from the Third Circuit is a very interesting case, and I think Mr. Bizarre has made reference to that in the Ash versus McCall case, where the Chancellor said in a footnote and in dicta that this court ought to consider overruling or at least adopting the approach taken in Blasband. And I must admit, Blasband, I think, but for one critical leap in its logic, gets most of Delaware law, I think, correct. Where it errs is in its conclusion that, let me step back a minute. Blasband was a plaintiff. He was a stockholder in a company called Eastco. And Eastco merged with Danaher and with a subsidiary of Danaher, and ultimately this plaintiff became a stockholder in Danaher Corporation. He brought a derivative suit as a Danaher stockholder, which is what we say the plaintiff here should have done, and in essence was bringing a double derivative claim, although the plaintiff in Blasband said, I'm not bringing a double derivative claim. He said, I'm bringing a claim based on my former ownership of Eastco shares. And the court went on at some length in addressing this, but ultimately said, you're right, you do have successor derivative standing, if you will, even though it really analyzed this as a question of whether or not the plaintiff had standing to pursue a double derivative claim. In fact, the court in Blasband said...
But after that went to the Third Circuit, and there was an amended complaint, and then when the amended complaint was certified to this court by Judge Lachem and Rails versus Blasband, we basically said it was a double derivative suit.
Yes, I believe that's absolutely correct, Your Honor, that it really was a double derivative suit that was at issue there. I think the Third Circuit had just gone one step too far in how it described the plaintiff's standing to pursue those claims, frankly, because it really did get it right. It said they had to make a demand on the parent company board. That's exactly what we say should happen here. They should have brought a double derivative suit on behalf of Kinross, and they just simply did not do that. And this court has had opportunities to comment. In the certified question proceeding Your Honor mentioned, the court sort of noted the procedural bind that it was in terms of commenting on the substance of Blasband, but nonetheless said in its opinion that nothing should be construed as this court accepting, in effect, the Third Circuit's holding in Blasband on the standing question. And in First Interstate, the Court of Chancery had an opportunity to comment on the Third Circuit's view because the plaintiff there also argued for the adoption of the Blasband rule. And the court said very bluntly that the Third Circuit's decision in Blasband is both inconsistent with the clear holding of Lewis versus Anderson, and it's immaterial to the decision in this case, as at most it would recognize plaintiff's ability to proceed double derivatively in the name of the acquiring company, something that plaintiff does not purport to do. And that's in the Chancery Court opinion. This court affirmed that ruling. The cases outside of Delaware that the plaintiff cites, frankly, again, are not on point. The Alford versus Shaw case from North Carolina, the Galliard case from the California Intermediate Appellate Court, both are construing particular statutory provisions about continuous ownership in those states. And other states have construed their continuous ownership requirements differently than Delaware. They, frankly, have just come out a very different way, and they've been that way for a long time. They don't purport to apply Delaware law at all. And one of the cases the plaintiff did rely on, the professional management case versus cost from the Minnesota court, adopted precisely and that case did purport to apply Delaware law, adopted the rule that we espouse here, which is the plaintiff does not have standing to pursue the claim in her capacity as a former stockholder of Amex. If anything, she should have stepped up to the plate and gone to the Kinross board and made a demand. That was a new board of directors charged with managing the business and affairs of that company under Ontario law, but the analogous provision would have been under 141A of the Delaware law. And those directors have, in the first instance, the right to determine whether or not to pursue this claim. On the substance of the fraud allegations, we think the Chancellor's opinion covered them very well. He went through very thoroughly the allegations about fraud in the complaint. He set forth, in his opinion, the actual allegations from the complaint and reviewed them and concluded that whether or not you applied the Rule 9B standard, the Rule 12B6 standard, or the Rule 23.1 standard didn't matter because these allegations were so conclusory as to be unhelpful and did not state a claim under any pleading standard. We submit that decision was absolutely correct, and the court ought to affirm Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion.
What is the context for the reference in Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion to the law of the case? When Vice Chancellor Jacobs dismissed then Vice Chancellor Jacobs dismissed the original complaint. He talks about if the purpose of the merger is merely to defeat a claim, and then Vice Chancellor Strine construes it as solely to defeat a claim, and he says, I'm bound by that reading as the law of the case. Was that in the context of some argument the lawyers were making?
No, it was not, Your Honor, to be honest. It was not an issue that we briefed below in terms of arguing the law of the case or the application of Vice Chancellor Jacobs' ruling. Certainly, we would have noted the Vice Chancellor's decision dismissing the first complaint, but we did not argue that that ruling was law of the case. And frankly, I don't believe ultimately there's a distinction between the way Vice Chancellor Jacobs may have phrased the rule in Lewis versus Anderson versus the way Vice Chancellor Strine applied it or phrased it in his opinion dismissing the amended complaint. I think it's frankly one and the same. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I have two or three brief comments if it pleases the court. The first comment I make, the record is totally clear on this. Amex Gold contributed significantly more to this transaction than did Kinross. Secondly, Mr. Lafferty, despite his eloquence, has not addressed the fact in his offering of the double derivative and his criticism of our failure to sue double derivatively, the fact that the claim would be barred by the statute of limitations, or that we would have no way of getting jurisdiction over Kinross. Lastly, the issue is not whose claim it is, but who has standing to sue. And in his review of Schreiber and Shaft cases, it must be noted that both those plaintiffs were bringing actions for wrongs occurring at a time when each of them did not own shares in the companies on whose behalf they were now suing. They own shares in the parent companies that are eventually divided or spun off. And we submit that rule equally applies here. We own shares in the parent company. We ought to be permitted to continue. We have the economic interest to continue this long pending case. Thank you.
And thank you both very much. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also take a brief recess.
Please rise. Thank you.